We're going to begin this morning with one of my favorite people when it comes to talking about the land and the people on the land, and just in general, one of my favorite people to listen to. Way back in 1974, I believe it was, this gentleman who's walking up here now, published his own book. It was called The East Bay Out, which was a guide to the hills and waterways and the Bay Area in and around Berkeley. And that book became Heyday Books. And for the last, well, I guess it's 40-some years, this gentleman has been publishing Heyday Books and offering a great voice to the Native Americans, started a magazine, Native California. I mean, I just can't sing his praises too loudly or too strongly. His book, The Ohlone Way, if you haven't read it, you must read it. You'll never look at the Bay Area the same again after reading this book by Malcolm Margolin, who is here to talk to us. And I'm going to leave the stage so I can watch you talk to us from out there. Welcome to Spirit Rock.
Well, thank you. Thank you, and I'll forgive you for calling me a gentleman. It does happen, and you learn to accept what life gives you, and accept it gracefully. Which I'm not doing. Hey, this is a terrible confession to make on Earth Day, but Thursday and Friday I was in Los Angeles, and I absolutely loved it. I had the most wonderful time in Los Angeles. The people there, the intensity of culture, the flocks of parrots, I mean, the exoticness of it all, and these pockets of artistic intensity. So, and I came back, and before I came back, I caught the plane late at night, coming back from LAX, and I stopped at my friend John and Ursula's house and had some wine, and they drove me to the airport, and because I was late on Southwest Airlines, my number was C14, which meant a center seat, and I ended up going in there, and the plane was full, and the seat that was available was between two young women. And one of them on the aisle was very blonde and very well coiffed and very icy, and she had a copy of Glamour magazine. And at the window was this young, chunky Chicano woman that was sitting there with a big smile and braces. And I sat between them thinking, isn't it wonderful the way life hands you metaphors? And I sat there in this metaphor, and this woman with the Glamour magazine, who had gotten herself all dressed up, I mean, she was stunning. Her skin was a tribute to the chemistry of the chemical industry of the United States. That, and she had clearly made herself up to be attractive. And yet there was something so forbidding about this. There was something that I just didn't want to know. And this young woman that was sitting next to me, her name was Monica. She was 20 years old. She had grown up in Los Angeles. Her parents were Mexicans. Her father didn't speak any English. This was her second trip on an airplane. She had never traveled anywhere. And she was coming up to see her boyfriend, and she was going to spend her first day ever in San Francisco. And we were talking about my own travels, and she was envying me for so much of the world that I've seen. And I was envying her for her youth, for her having a boyfriend, for her going to have the first day in San Francisco, that first vision of San Francisco, that first day of Golden Gate Park. And they were young. They were probably going to end up doing all the wrong things. They were going to go to Pier 39. But... but that's what you do when you're young. And I was thinking, when I was figuring what I'm going to say today to honor Scoop's good opinion of me, And not to embarrass him or myself or my various friends in this room, I thought I would talk a little bit about first sightings, about these first impressions. And my entry into California was back in 1967. It was the summer of love. And my wife and I were living in the Lower East Side of New York, and we got a car, and we came out to see what was happening in this wonderful place called the Bay Area. And we drove across country, and we had a guide, Rand McNally's guide to campgrounds. And we stopped at various places along the way and camped free. And when we came over this to this, when we entered California, there was this wonderful place that had all these dots for campgrounds. It was Yosemite National Park. And I said, that must be where my people are. So we came into Yosemite. We came over the Sierra, and we entered the Yosemite Valley. And it was 1967. It was summertime. There was camping places in Yosemite Valley. And we ended up spending 3 days on air mattresses going down the Merced River. And we would just lie on these air mattresses. And we thought we'd try it out. And we ended up going down the river on the air mattress and floating in these wonderful luminous cliffs, the balmy air, the coldness of the water. And you float down on that air mattress and you get down as far as you can get before your skin is all wrinkled up like a prune. And then you hitchhike back, and we hitchhike back to the car. And the next day we couldn't think of anything better to do, so we air mattressed down the Merced River. And the third day we couldn't think of anything better to do, so we went down on the Merced River on an air mattress. And then we came back to Yosemite Village to get some food. And there was one of these boxes with a newspaper in it. And there was the San Francisco Chronicle. And the headlines were, LSD causes birth defects. And we sat by the banks of the Merced River and cried our eyes out because we would never be able to have kids because of these birth defects. And the it was in a way like a baptism. The water, there's a wonderful Yiddish statement saying about how it's translated as like soap to the body, tears to the soul. And there was something about coming over. There was something about the river. There was something about the beauty. There was something about the tears. And there was something about that feeling that we just screwed up our whole lives. And there was nothing to live, that we were free or not free. I'm not sure what we were. Life was not in our control. Things happened to you. And there was a kind of opening, and we went off to San Francisco, and we looked at the summer of love on the Haight and Golden Gate Park. And those who haven't experienced it, I'm sorry to say you missed something, because it was utterly open, and it was wonderful, and it was magical, and there was a sense of a new world being born. Later on, I've got three kids and I've got four grandchildren. And if this is what birth defects look like, I'd like to recommend it to everybody. I think of first sightings. The first human beings came to the Bay Area about 13,000, 14,000 years ago. It was the end of the Pleistocene. There was no San Francisco Bay then. The water was tied up in glaciers. The water level was lower. You could walk out to the Farallones. There was a river that came through the Sacramento and the San Joaquin River met, and they flowed through this big grassy meadow that's now San Francisco Bay. And it flowed around. Angel Island was a kind of hill in this grassy meadow, and it flowed around what's now Raccoon Strait, and it came to the Golden Gate. And at the Golden Gate, there was a waterfall like Niagara Falls, and the water spilled over that waterfall. And then there was this plain that stretched out to the Farallones. And grazing on that plain were Columbia mammoths, were camels, were zebras, were bison, were all the great megafauna of the Pleistocene. There were short-nosed bears, there were dire wolves, there were saber-toothed cats, There were ground sloths, giant ground sloths. This was not that long ago. There was this other world that the first human beings saw when they came to this country, when they came to this wonderful land. And I think of it, and I think of its traceries that are still around today. Those Columbia elephants, they had wallows, and many people think that the vernal pools were the wallows of these Columbia mammoths, that the trails that they made later became Indian trails and later became our roadways, that there's the pronghorn antelope that is running 60 miles an hour. It runs 60 miles an hour at tremendous biological sacrifice. To run 60 miles an hour, it has enormous lungs. It has great heart that pumps blood into those lungs. It has spectacular and highly evolved musculature. It's light, and all of the other organs are crunched in. And it's this tremendous biological price that it pays to run 60 miles an hour. And why? The only other predator around that it needs to worry about is the coyote. And the coyote in a burst can run 20 miles an hour. And what evolution teaches us is the pronghorn antelope should run 21 miles an hour. Why is it running 60 miles an hour? Because it's outrunning the cheetahs from the Pleistocene. And that always struck me as so amazing, the way we lead our lives, the way we are still outrun, the way our bodies, our thoughts, our souls, our beings have formed around things in the distant past. We're still outrunning enemies that no longer exist. We still have lives that have been shaped by a past that no longer matters. The Pleistocene, I would have loved to have been around for the Pleistocene. I would have loved to have been around when the first Europeans came to the Bay Area, when the Portola expedition of 1769 came up and came around. They were looking for Monterey Bay. It was the first land expedition, and they were looking for Monterey Bay, and they had missed it. They came up the Salinas River, and they looked at the old maps that the seacoast, that the old captains had left them, and they looked, and it didn't look like anything that Monterey Bay was supposed to look like. And they came around, and they were lost, and they were scared, and they were in a strange country. And everywhere they looked, there were miracles. They came upon redwood trees. They'd never seen redwood trees before. And they measured them, and they thought they were so astonishing. And then there was a village that they came to where the people had deserted it. And on a pole was a bird that had been an effigy of a bird, a stuffed bird. And they talked about the wings being 13 feet across, and it was condor, and they'd never seen anything like this before. And they and the elk that were there, and they came along, and there's both this kind of lost, and they're feuding, and they don't know where they're going, and every day is a miracle. And they come up to Pacifica, where Pacifica is, and there was an Indian village, Protestock, and they stopped, they saw the Farallon Islands, and this was a known navigational point, and they could take sightings. They could figure out where in the world they were, and they sent some guy named Ortega, Sergeant Ortega, up into the hills to hunt for deer. And he went up with four men, and they reached the top of the ridge, Sweeney Ridge, and they looked down, and there was the bay in front before them. No European had ever seen it before. Un immenso brazo del mar, an immense arm of the sea. And they talked about how around the fringe of the bay were fires from various Indian villages that were there. And I'd always wondered, I spent so many years wondering what it would have been to walk down into that bay, to walk down into that bay with the pronghorn antelope on Mission Peak, with the geese and the ducks that were flying in flocks that were so thick they darkened the sky, and their wing beats were like thunder, like hurricanes, that the grizzly bears that were along the creek, the salmon that was so thick running through the bay, that as they ran through the Carquinez Straits, the common description was it looked like they could walk across the straits on the backs of the salmon. The Indian villages, all those people that lived here. It's an amazing world. Another first sighting was about 20 years ago, it must have been, that the poet Yevtushenko came to Berkeley. And And Mark Dubois from Friends of the River was asked to, were you on that trip? Do I remember you on that trip, Scoop? Yeah, there was so Yevtushenko came and Mark Dubois got some friends together and we to show Yevtushenko, the Russian poet, a good time. And he had just come from Russia with his translator, who was a guy from Brooklyn. And this character from Brooklyn had married a Russian woman who was a Eurasian actress, who was the most gorgeous woman I'd ever seen in my life. And she, and the day before they had landed in New York City, and he had tried to bring her to see his family in Brooklyn, and she got lost in the New York subway, and she was didn't speak any English, and she was traumatized. So Yevtushenko, who tends to be grouchy, and the translator who was humiliated, and the woman who was traumatized, come in, and we're going to show them a good time. And but we were up to that challenge. There was a wonderful picnic that we had on the slopes of Mount Tamalpais, and the grass was, and there were picnic baskets, and there was bottles of white wine and baguettes and cheese, and there was a spread to put out, and the grass was green, and there were flowers around, and there were puffy white clouds, and there were breezes, and there were little sailboats in the bay. And we sat around and we looked at it, and then we went off to to Green Gulch, to the Zen Center, and we looked at the gardens and we talked to the monks, and then we walked down to Muir Beach and we spent some time on Muir Beach, and there were some naked people around that looked very lovely, and then we walked back to Pelican Inn and we had a drink, and then we came back to the Zen Center and we talked to the monks, and then we drove into San Francisco and we walked around North Beach, and then we were sitting in Green's restaurant. And it was, we're sitting in Green's restaurant, this beautiful Russian actress looks at her husband and says something in Russian. And he looks at me and he says, she wanted to thank you from the bottom of her heart and say that it's as if all of her life she's been in a box and today somebody let her out. The capacity of the world to change and the capacity of this world to retain beauty is just absolutely spectacular. It reminds me, I've been working with Ken Brower, who's David Brower's son. We did a book on David Brower, and we're doing a book on restoring Hetch Hetchy. And Ken told me the most wonderful story. He told me the story of when his father was trying to save Glen Canyon, which was David Brower's great defeat, that he went with his father to Glen Canyon, and they went there to... And they were walking around and they visited this side canyon, this little slot canyon. And they came into this canyon and he was with his father. And the walls of the canyon were sandstone, that marvelous colors of old sandstone, those pastel blues and pinks and blushes and oranges and yellows. And there was a tracery of vegetation coming down from the top, and there was water dripping through the vegetation, and there were birds flying back and forth. And he stood there with his father and he realized this was the most beautiful place he'd ever seen in his life. It was flooded when they built the dam. And many years later, there was a drought and the waters receded. And when the waters receded, you could now go back into the canyon, and he brought his own son back into that canyon. And he walked into the canyon, and when he walked in, the walls were dull from years underwater. There was no tracery of vegetation. There was no dripping of water from creeks. There were no birds. And he realized the place had been wrecked, and he was so ashamed that he brought his son there. And his son said, "Dad, this is the most beautiful place I've ever seen in my life." There's the changing beauty of the world, and I'm not sure how we deal with this. I'm not sure how we deal with change. I watch environmentalists trying to freeze things, trying to protect species, trying to protect, and I am sympathetic toward it, but I don't think it's possible. I think change is there. I think things are going to change. One of the behind that change, there's something else. There's fecundity, there's variety, there's life force. There are things that need to be thought about behind the change. But it's that human spirit. It's what David Brower, it's what Ken Brower was, what that story means to me is there's something in the human spirit that sees beauty. No matter where, that we're programmed to see it, we're programmed to appreciate it, and the world changes. That it, I've been hanging around Indians for the last 30 years, and there's an anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, and he calls anthropology deep hanging out. And this is what I've been doing, is deep hanging out. And I'm good at it. And I advise it as something that might be tried, that you just kind of hang out. And if you're lucky, people talk to you and you learn things. But in my years of hanging out, one of my favorite stories that I've mentioned this here before, it was the roundhouse at Chaucer. And there were these Indian, there were roundhouses throughout the Sierra, throughout Central California. And these roundhouses were centers of study. They were centers of culture. They were places where the great dances were held, where stories would be told, where singers would sing, where ceremonies, it was like a hotel, where you'd put up strangers. And these roundhouses replicated, people would sit in the roundhouse in those old days in ways that replicated the structure of the culture around them. So you had reciprocating arrangements with different clans. That clan would bury our dead, we'd bury their dead. That clan, we'd give them salmon, they'd give us elk. That you had different arrangements with these different clans, and you'd sit around in the roundhouse in ways that replicated the social structure. And roundhouse culture fell apart after the Second World War, the traditional roundhouse culture, and for various reasons. And there was a guy named Bill Franklin who was a part of the, as a young man, he was a dancer in the roundhouse at Ione in Buena Vista. It's on the way to Jackson in the foothills. And he grew, and Ione was the greatest of these roundhouses. They talk about that as if it were Princeton, as if it were Yale. It was the place where Pedro Connor came and told the creation myth. It was the places where the grand dancers would come for the real world for the world renewal ceremonies. And when Bill Franklin went into the war in the Second World War, he came out and the roundhouse roof had collapsed and nobody was doing the dances anymore. And it had ended. So he went off and he did what many people of that generation did. He moved off to Shingle Springs. He got a job as a logger. He was a choke setter. And he built a house in Shingle Springs, and he raised his kids. And it got to be the 50s, and it got to be the 60s, and he looked around, and he realized it was gone. That old world was gone. So he got his kids together and the kids' Indian friends, and they went out, and they got roadkill, and they made the deerskin regalia. They made the flicker band feathers. He built onto his house, he built a rec room, and he taught them the songs and he taught them the dances. Then around the late 60s, he got together with Glenn Villa of Buena Vista and Burris of Mariposa and several other people, and they decided to build another roundhouse. And they built this roundhouse at Chaucer, at Grinding Rock State Park. And they wanted it at a state park because they wanted it, if it was on a reservation, it would belong to one particular people. So they wanted it to be for all Indians. And they built this roundhouse, and these roundhouses are semi-subterranean, they're underground. You go in, there's poles, there's darkness, there's a... The audience sits around, the dancers dance in the center. There's a fire that's at the center. Off to the side is the floor drum, and it's the chorus. One old guy will stand there with a big pole and bang on the floor drum, and everybody else is singing with their clapper sticks, and the dancers come. And they built this dance house, this roundhouse, and it was in the 70s, it lasted until 1990 or so, and the roof collapsed. And then it lasted, they rebuilt it, and it's still operating. The roof collapsed again last year. And they're in the middle of rebuilding it now. And it was the most wonderful place. They have, every year they have big times, celebrations that are open to the public. There are times when you go there and people come from old cultures that have to do things in roundhouses. They have to commemorate the dead. They have to name kids. They'll come in at 3 o'clock in the morning. They'll do what they have to do and leave. So one day I'm out there talking to my friend Dwight Dutschke, who was Burris's grandson, and I'm talking about how the roundhouse was built. And I'm talking about how the poles were set, how the doorway faces the east, where the wood comes in, the dimensions of it. And finally, Dwight looks at me and he says, I know what you're getting at with these questions. And I said, what do you think I'm getting at? He says, you're getting at the fact that we didn't build it very good. I said, geez, no, I mean, that's not what I'm getting at. He says, we didn't. We didn't build it very good because we're into construction. We know how to build things. We know when you put the posts in, you can't just put posts in the bare ground. You need creosote. You need drainage. You could put it in concrete. There was nothing that said we couldn't do that. When we tied the rafters, we tied them with grapevine. There was nothing that said we had to use grapevine. We could have used nails. We could have used metal. We could have made this thing to last 100 years. But we didn't, because there was another rule we had to follow. I said, what's that? And he says, you have to build it so it falls apart every 20 years. That way, every generation knows how to rebuild it. There's something about this idea of a permanent environment. There's something about this idea of species and land and things frozen into a particular time that doesn't strike me as all that real. And I'm not sure how to deal with it at all, because conservation organizations are set up to collect money to maintain land and species for perpetuity. Our whole we've done such damage, you don't want to just say, let it go. And yet, on the other hand, I remember when I was in Hawaii, Tom Layton at Gribody Foundation sent me to Hawaii to view some of the projects that they were doing there. And I would see these people up in the mountains where there was this little couple of acres of land where they were struggling to maintain some snail, and the amount of effort that it was taking, the invasion of plants upon this thing. And maybe you can maintain a couple of acres, but can you maintain a whole world that way? I mean, things change. And the thing that I've been so fascinated by, I've been going up to the Sacramento Valley, to the Sacramento River, and I've been dealing with the rice farmers up there, Bryce Lundberg, and these wildlife refuges that they have, the ducks and the geese. And you come into these wildlife refuges, and there's a sense of the antique plenty of it all. There's these flights of deep gusset. When the snow geese come in, you can feel it in the chest because it's so massive. When they lift off, there's that roaring sound. It's one of the great, if you haven't done it, get up there. Just the roaring of those wings as they take off, as rafts of them fly around. It's the sound of the earth. It's the sound of the power of the earth. That's all artificial. Those are not the antique marshes. Those were created. Those were the rice farmers are flooding their fields at various times to give these animals their due, to give these geese a place where they can feed and rest during the flight, during the migration. There's something about, hey, I'm struggling with this one. There's something about this sense that we have that people are no good, that people have destroyed the world, that we can't live within this, that we can't have a world that has people and animals that were a cancer. I don't believe it. I think that the Indians lived here for all these years. There was an active relationship with the environment. There was burning, there was hunting, there was cultivation. There was something about the human enterprise. There's something about living with this world. There's something about those geese and those ducks up there and that world that's being built. What we owe Earth is our best efforts, and what we owe Earth is our honesty. Hey, this is an irreverent way to end things for me, but I've been flashed the 5 minute sign. But what I've really, there was a wonderful social critic, Lars Larson. He used to write for the New York Review of Books, and he had the most marvelous statement that he made once. And he said, "The enemy is not conservatism. The enemy is not liberalism. The enemy is bullshit." And there's something about looking at the world as it is. There's something about looking at this, at who we are. There's something about, there's that marvelous aphorism of Kierkegaard that the root of all unhappiness is comparison. Yeah. And I think, and that's one of the few things that I know that you can't talk me out of in 5 minutes. And there's something about our duty to the world is not to keep things the same. Our duty to the world is to look under what underlies, to look at the fertility of it, to look at the variety of it, to accept the sadness of things that have gone, to accept our capacity to love this and to be happy and to enjoy it. Hey, that's what I got to say.